there, and they were fascinated with the Indian culture, and his books sold more readily there than always here. But it was also the time of like Wyatt Earp and, you know, some of those
Wild Bill.
Bill, you know, and he was kind of in that beginning of that, and so it was very popular, and he wrote several books. He actually came back in 1893 to Park Rapids, took a train up, brought his daughter to re-challenge where the source was. And he retraced it. And in the Park Rapids Enterprise, they have pictures of Willard Glazier standing in downtown Park Rapids. And he kept trying to say that Elk Lake was never discovered. But this one young man I mentioned as you and I were walking in 1834 was there.
Alexander the Young.
He was there. No, this wasn't Alexander the Younger. He was from 1803. This was another young man, just a wealthy dandy who came out, and he sat with the Indians on the village site and watched the little kids play. And not only that, in 1881, people in Park Rapids area were already taking wagons up on Sundays and picnicking on the shore of Elk Lake.
Wow.
And
tourism started earlier.
Yeah, it did. And Glazier said it was undiscovered, as picnickers on Sunday were up there, you know, looking down on the lake. So he was so full of it, and his family admitted it. They just said, yeah, he was just an adventure writer. You know, yellow journalism back then.
Do you mind if I ask you a question about what you do, like as a tour guide and all that sort of stuff?
What do I do?
Like, no, I mean, like, just a question about that. Like, could, you know, when you're telling the story of, like, indigenous rights or, like, the land being, you know, pioneered and stuff like that, or the fact that you bring up climate change and stuff, do you ever get issues from people when they're...
There are some people who deny climate change happens.
And they'll take you up on that? Like, they'll, yeah.
But, you know, like I tell them, I said, all I can base it on is, one, the Varp Corings from 10,000 years. We have the history there. Mm. And then I also tell them, meteorologists like, what is his name? He used to work for WCCO. He's a state climatologist now, and he wrote two weather books. He's been working with the biological station here. We've been recording weather data for decades. And he goes, all I'm doing is reading the numbers. All we do is I only retell what the numbers are. I don't try and say my opinion on things. I say, these are numbers. We know for a fact. Our springs are coming earlier. Our falls are coming later. Our winters are more mild. You combine that then with, like, the insect, our disease and insect specialists in forestry, and they know the biology of insect larvae. You can kill them at 6 days of 40 below. We're not getting it. So what's happening? They're seeing upticks in all these insects. And all I'm doing is I'm pulling from all the different sciences.
Because you're just very good at explaining it in a way that would probably not make anyone, like, we're all trying to, like, reach over the aisle, right, and try to figure out ways to talk about this stuff that doesn't make it, like, turn moderates into militants, you know what I mean? Like,
and that's the thing.
And you're great because you say, like, we might be advancing the process that's natural.
Right.
Which is a beautiful way of...
And the thing is, too, everybody has to come from it from their life experiences and what they've experienced in life. And I mean, I'm going to be 55. I remember as a little kid when it was cool and we had a ton of snow. I remember starting here in 95 when we had snow. And then I remember changing my hikes to snow boot walks because we had no snow. And I remember talking to people who've lived there their whole life in their 70s. And they said, we've never had winters where there was no snow. I mean, and then you take the data from the field station. And so I'm taking from the experiences and the data I have, and I share it with others, and they have to put it into perspective of their life experiences. And usually when I try and say, I remember when I was a kid, and then all of a sudden they go, you know, you're right. They start reflecting on their personal experiences.
I mean,
and I found that's always kind of the best way, is you try and say, this is that. You start putting it together, and it makes you wonder. And then
I was wondering also if, like, over your... I'm sorry if I'm keeping you too long.
Oh, no.
From 1995 on, too, because it seems like that's the last 5 years or so is, like, where people are having flights canceled, and, like, their lives are being changed.
And especially, like, 1999, 2000 is when these dramatic weather events happened. And when I started in 1995, I actually started in the end of June. And in 2 weeks later, in July, on July 13th, ironically, it was the day Schoolcraft discovered the headwaters, like, a couple hundred years earlier. But I always say, I think it's his ghost. We had horrendous 3 nights of terrible storms, and they were what they called 100-year or century storms. And we have now had 5 century storms since 1999 hit this park. And it was like, wait a minute. If these are century storms, why? And I go through the Park Rapids Enterprises. We pull up articles. We record every article that talks about storms. We know July is a stormy cycle at Itasca. We know strong winds come through, but the gauge at the university broke at 120 miles an hour in that 95 windstorm. In 99, when the boundary waters were hit, the storm started right here where it hits the forest land, and it decimated the south end of the park. But nobody sees it because there's no hiking trails there. We were hit in 2008. We got 8 inches of rain in about 2 hours. That the headwaters post was underwater.
Wow.
Half, you know, a quarter of the way up, and it was tipping over. That log floated downstream. We recovered that before it went out of the park. The boardwalk that you're walking on had to be replaced because the boardwalk was floating away. The whole boardwalk.
Crazy.
And that footbridge over there washed out the footings, and we had to replace it. And this whole area was closed for a week until the water level could go down, and that was in late June because people...
So you really experienced it in the last 15, 20
years.
Yeah,
and since about 1999 for sure, because 1995 we kind of had a little gap, 4 years, but then after that it's about every 4 years. 2012, this area here was hit. This was flattened. It took out a whole bunch of trees right behind us here and on the point there. And in 2016, when it was our park's 125th birthday, we had another one hit the visitor center in the east entrance, and it came through. You can see where these all come through, and these are all what they keep saying are century storms. But it's like, why am I seeing five or six century storms?
It's not 100 years, is it?
In 15 years.
Wow.
Every 4 years.
One other tiny question, because I found it's interesting that you use the word Indian. I find this interesting. Like,
American
in Canada,
Indian.
Yeah, we don't.
They're indigenous people.
Yeah, you get this kind of. I'm not. I didn't want to say it also in front of everybody because I don't. Mine, but is that a thing here?
They call them American Indians.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't say Native American because I'm Native American. I was born in America.
Hmm.
So you can't use that anymore.
Yeah.
But they say they are American Indian.
They use that, huh?
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. They use that, and that's what we use.
It varies from regions.
Exactly.
But pretty much nationally in Canada, I'm Canadian, they have obviously it's a reference to the fact that they thought they were in Asia and all this whole long story.
Yep. And I know one of our, he's a sociology major, Tim Holzkam. He works with the First Nation people in Canada on treaty rights. He's done that his whole life. And he always calls them First Nation or Indigenous people. So sometimes it depends on my group. I'll use like American Indian or Indigenous or First Nation people.
Yeah.
I'll use it interchangeably. But here, the Indians here through the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, they say American Indian.
Interesting. Wow.
In Minnesota.
It just goes to show there's lots of different kinds of natives. You don't want to be like too heterogeneous about it or homogeneous about it.
And that's where like with the Ojibwa people, Chippewa is the word you use less because that's kind of a derogatory version of Ojibwa. But I don't call them when I'm by them. I don't call them, they are the Anishinaabe people, but I don't call them Anishinaabe when I talk to them, and I don't use that because I'm not Anishinaabe. And they use that with each other, but I'm not. And so I call them Ojibwa.
Hmm.
And then they'll sometimes call themselves Chenobs or Chenob, short for Anishinaabe.
That's cute.
And then, but I can call them Ojibwa. But, you know, when you hear those versions, you can see where the words Chippewa may have come through in hearing a foreign language and stuff. But we use that less, though they use it in their names.
Makes me think of that Gordon Lightfoot song.
There's a couple of, like Grand Portage, their Grand Portage Chippewa Nation. It depends on the individual bands if they want to use Chippewa or Ojibwa.
It does matter who's saying it, you know what I mean?
Exactly. And each band doesn't get along with each other. The White Earth Indians hate the Red Lakers. They call them the Hillbilly Indians. Red Lakers never ceded their land to the white people, so theirs is a closed reservation. And, they don't even get along with each other necessarily. Mm. And they're all, you know, Ojibwa, but you can't even classify them.
Well, neither do we.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'll
leave
you. I don't want to take your time too much.
Well, it was wonderful.
You were amazing at this.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much,
Connie.
You
have a great time. Go dip your feet in the river.
I'm going. Oh, I'm going.
The blessings you waited for. You need to take your feet off.